September 11th, 2001. If you were alive on that day, you remember it quite well. 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four different airplanes in four coordinated attacks. Two planes hit New York City's World Trade Center towers, and within an hour and 42 minutes, both of those 110-story towers collapsed to the ground. A third plane crashed into the Pentagon, and the west side partially collapsed. And then there was a fourth plane that actually did not reach its intended target, the Capitol building or the White House. And the reason for that is because there were some valiant passengers on the plane that heroically revolted against the terrorists. And as a result, the plane crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. All total, there were 2,996, just four shy of 3,000, and a little over 6,000 who were injured on that September morning. All of you, again, who are alive on that day, remember those events well. You don't really even need me to recount them for you. And even those who weren't alive, no doubt you have seen the pictures and you have seen the videos as well. What you might not know about that day, however, is what the advisors to the president, George W. Bush, told him to do. They counseled him to safely retreat to a bunker far away from Washington, D.C. The president told them that he would not do that. He told them that he was going to come back to the White House once Air Force One was refueled, and that there was no discussion about the matter. And by 7 p.m. that evening, he was in the White House. Now, it certainly makes sense that the president's advisors told him to retreat to a safe and secure location. If you recall that September day, there was obviously a lot of danger, but with that danger, there was a whole lot of uncertainty as well, and the uncertainty just kept building as the day went along. You remember when the first plane hit, we all looked at that and thought, whoa, what a horrible accident that is. Then the second plane hit, and then we knew, okay, there's a terrorist attack. Something is happening, but we don't know what. And then the third plane hit the Pentagon, and that raised alarm even higher and uncertainty even more, because if this enemy, whoever it is, can hit the headquarters for the Defense Department, then what else can they do? Uncertainty kept rising. But President Bush was resolved to show strength. He did not want to show any kind of fear. He did not want to run and hide. And so he purposely took refuge in the White House. Apparently, King David went through a similar situation when he composed Psalm 11. The psalmist was in great danger. The wicked were after him. His enemies were bending their bows in order to shoot arrows at him. And so David's well-meaning but fearful friends advised him to flee Jerusalem, flee to the mountains, which would have been basically the ancient equivalent to a bunker. Everything seemed dangerous. The uncertainty kept building. And so the king's advisors told him to run and hide. But as we're going to see in the psalm tonight, David refused their counsel. He said he didn't need to flee to the mountains because God was his true refuge. His strength, his confidence was in the Lord's power to protect him. Now, we don't know for certain exactly what situation spurred David to write Psalm 11. Scripture does talk about two prominent examples in which David actually did flee from Jerusalem. Of course, there was King Saul, who turned on him, and then even his own son Absalom, who mounted a rebellion against David. And so, as some scholars contend, he could have written Psalm 11 in light of one of those occasions. But it seems rather doubtful that he did that, because it seems that David actually stayed in Jerusalem. So more than likely, David wrote Psalm 11 in response to another incident in his life. And we do know that there were several dangers, challenges, threats during his reign. We just simply don't know which one in particular he wrote Psalm 11 in response to. When we look at the superscription to this psalm, we are not given any more hints. We do know, obviously, David is the human author under the Spirit's inspiration that wrote the psalm. And we also know his intent, its intended use. It was written to the choir master, which, again, was the worship leader who would have used this psalm in congregational worship services. But we don't know the particular threat. All we know is that it was quite serious. It was a national crisis that threatened to overturn the stability of Israel. The very moral foundations of the people were crumbling. Apparently, this upheaval was caused by evil men who were trying to track down David in order to harm him. And then on top of all that, David has these advisors, these people who were loyal to him, but they were panicking. And they were telling David, get out of here, get out of the capital city. But David doesn't do that. Instead, he remains calm, keeping his eyes on the Lord. So while his friends feared for his life, David did not. He didn't join in their fears. It's apparent that he did not walk by sight and in fear. Instead, he walked by faith, trusting in the Lord. So when we come to Psalm 11, understand that it's not a prayer like we see in so many of the Psalms. And instead, it is an expression, a statement of David's confidence. It is faith's response to fear's counsel. When David's anxious, well-meaning friends ask, if the foundations of society are destroyed, what can the righteous do? David responded by declaring his faith in God. Here's what you do. You trust in the Lord. And this is what we need to do as well. When the foundations of our lives, when the foundations of the society in which we live are crumbling around us, we need to trust in the Lord, our refuge. James Montgomery Boyce referred to sort of the key question in our psalm, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Boyce says that is the burning question of the day, isn't it? Along these lines, Boyce asks, what shall we do when the laws are not upheld, when morality is undermined and evil sweeps on unchecked? What shall we do when the Bible is undermined and its teachings disregarded, when even churchmen seem to support the rising tide of secularism? What shall we do when family values are crumbling and the tide of frequent divorce sweeps forward with increasing damage to children, parents, and society alike? What can we do when everything around us seems to be giving way? Some counsel hiding, that is, running away from what is happening. David's response was to take refuge in the Lord. David's example is quite helpful to us when we feel like the foundations of our lives and society are crumbling. You take society, for example, when it comes to society in our own society, doesn't it feel like each day another foundational stone is removed? It seems like almost every day another step is taken down the path of deep, deep depravity in our nation. Each day it feels like another attack is launched against Christianity and against Christians. Verbal and other forms of persecution, are already happening in the U.S. And it just makes you wonder how much longer before the physical persecution begins. I think most Christians in our nations today have a growing sense of uncertainty. And this makes them ask the question that we see in Psalm 11. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Well, David answers that question for us in Psalm 11. He tells us what persecuted believers must do, and he examples to them how they are to do it. Here's what King David writes in Psalm 11. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur, and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. From this psalm, David reminds us, in a society of crumbling foundations, persecuted believers must take refuge in the Lord. Again, David's example in this psalm tells us how to make this application. We can discern that persecuted believers must do three things to take refuge in the Lord. They must rest, reject, and reaffirm. First of all, rest. Believers must take refuge in the Lord by resting fully in Him alone. As we see in verse 1, David examples that believers rest in the Lord by resting in Him explicitly and exclusively. Notice first how David explicitly declares his trust in God. He opens up by testifying, in the Lord I take refuge. When his life was on the line, David remained confident in the Lord. And you'll notice here, he doesn't remain quiet about it. He proclaims this out loud for everyone to hear. God is my refuge. Now, as probably many of you are aware, an ancient refuge was a fortress of protection. It was a place where you could flee from your enemies and a place where you could have rest. But what David is saying here, true rest, not just rest for the body, but for the whole person, body and soul, comes only from the Lord, exclusively. You notice here, David's faint-hearted advisors suggested leaving Jerusalem to go to the hills, to go to the mountains for refuge. So when you think of a refuge, of course, even in ancient times, a refuge could have been a fortress, like a building. But a refuge could have also been the mountains, which was a sort of natural fortress. Now, technically, we're not told exactly who David is responding to in verse 1. But I feel quite confident in saying that he is not responding to himself, as some have suggested, because the word you in verse 1 is actually in the plural. So he can't be talking to himself. He's clearly talking to a group, not an individual. And he is not talking to his enemies either. Some have suggested, well, he's perhaps responding to his enemies. But that really doesn't make much sense, because why would his enemies who are trying to kill him advise him to flee from them? And why would the wicked call themselves the wicked? The wicked never call themselves the wicked. So these possibilities don't make much sense. So nearly all of the scholars agree that David is likely responding to the counsel of his political and military advisors, these well-meaning supporters, but supporters who were weak-willed, wanted David to run. They thought the enemy was too strong. And so to these advisors, David asked, "How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain?" David was amazed. He marveled at how his advisors could counsel him in this way, because essentially they were counseling him to defy his trust in the Lord. And so it's quite obvious the king wants to make a point to them. He told them, "Look, I don't need to quickly and quietly fly away from my troubles like a bird to the mountain for security and safety. My safety is in the Lord alone. I'm in His hands. I'm going to exclusively trust Him." You see, what David's saying here is, I'm not going to find my refuge in something or someone else other than the Lord. I'm not going to put my trust in a false refuge. I'm not going to find refuge in myself. I'm not going to find it in armies or a fortress or a wilderness stronghold, a mountain. No, I'm going to solely rely on the Lord. You know, when a trial or persecution comes into our life, it is quite tempting for us to trust in something else or someone else other than the Lord. For example, if you are verbally attacked for your faith, it can be tempting to trust in your wit, trust in your sharp tongue to protect yourself. It's tempting to just lash back at that person attacking you rather than trusting in the Lord and responding in a Christ-like manner. And don't misunderstand me here tonight. I'm not suggesting in any way that we should be individuals who take foolish risk or individuals who fail to exercise wise caution. But at the same time, we should not live our lives in fear of what could happen to us. Let me ask you tonight, is that you? Do you live in fear of wrong that could be done to you? Do you fret over potential dangers? Do you fear medical problems, a disease, illness? Do you find yourselves fretting accidents or random acts of violence or natural disasters or being robbed or the government intruding too much into your life? We shouldn't constantly worry about someone or something hurting us or taking advantage of us. And I just want to say to you tonight, if you find yourself doing that, you are struggling with the sin of worry. And I know that's one of those sins that most Christians kind of accept, don't think it's a big deal. But it should be unacceptable to us as Christians, because it is a big deal. It is a big problem to worry, because worry ultimately says I have to trust either in myself or in other people or other things other than the Lord. I have to trust in some mountain in my life other than God for my refuge. I have to trust in my savings account. I have to trust in my quick wit and sharp tongue. I have to trust in my weapons or my security system or my medications or my treatments or the right eating plan. We could go on and on. I have to trust in these things for my security instead of the Lord. So I ask you here tonight, honestly before God, whom are you really putting your trust in, or what are you really putting your trust in? Is it in some kind of mountain, or is it in the Lord? Brethren, each one of us has an appointment with death. And there's nothing we can do to change that appointed day. It will happen. The question is, are we going to trust God in all of our circumstances throughout life, leading up to and including our deaths? We shouldn't live in fear of what might happen. Instead, we need to trust in the Lord to protect us until He's finished using us here on earth. You'll recall from our study through John, really, Jesus is the ultimate example of this. John 7 records, "Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, 'Is not this the man whom the Jewish authorities seek to kill? And yet here he is, speaking openly. So they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Jesus was not going to be harmed or killed until the appointed time. And listen, the same is true for us. When we really believe this, then we can say as David does in Psalm 56, "In God I trust, I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me?" All I'm saying is we just shouldn't live our lives gripped by fear. Because nothing catches the Lord off guard. If we're going to go through a crisis or a trial, it's because ultimately he wants us to go through that trial in order to spiritually strengthen us. It's for our good and for his glory. And so we just need to trust him in it. Whatever is coming in our life, we know it is for our good. God gives us good gifts, including trials. And so this means we should not listen to wrong counsel, whether that counsel comes from ourselves or from other people, but wrong counsel that encourages us to flee and to fear. This is a faithless approach. And this brings us to the second thing persecuted believers must do to take refuge in the Lord. They must reject faithless advice. As we see in verses 1 through 3, we see two characteristics of faithless advice that believers should reject. First, they must reject advice which departs from the world. You see, because David was trusting in God, you'll notice here, he's not trying to run away, escape his problems. And this is why he was disappointed. He wasn't happy with the advice that he got from his counselors. So again, verse 1, David rebuked them. And the way he did this is by repeating their own words back to them. He asked them, "How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain?" You know, David understood something that we need to often remind ourselves about. And it's simply this. We cannot run away from our problems. We cannot run away from potential harm. So isolating ourselves or isolating our families from the world so that we're never hurt by anything or anyone simply is not God's will. God's will for us is to be witnesses in this world for his glory. And we have to understand, though, when we do that, we're going to be persecuted for doing so. And that is God's will for us. All who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Don't misunderstand me tonight. I'm not saying that there's never a time to find a restful place. I'm not saying there's never a time to have vacation, to relax, rejuvenate. I'm not saying there's never a time where we don't try to get away from our problems, leave them behind. But at the same time, we have to understand we can't do that forever. That's just not real life. We can't keep running from our problems or potential problems or persecution. We should not run away out of fear. Instead, like David, we need to find ourselves standing firm and putting our faith in God, knowing that he will protect us. And notice here, as we see in David's advisors, departure from the world is usually driven by what? It is driven by a despair over the world. And this is the second characteristic of faithless advice that believers should reject. You see, David's counselors, they were terrified of the harm that could potentially come their way. These enemies seemed poised to attack. They advised David, therefore, to flee. Why? Because, verse 2, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. Now, these statements here by David's advisors suggest that these enemies were within the walls of Jerusalem. They were internal foes. They were fellow Israelites. And what were they doing? They were hiding in the dark shadows with bowstrings pulled, with arrows ready to be fired. Now, perhaps David's advisors were referring to a metaphorical attack instead of a literal attack. Perhaps these bows and arrows that are mentioned here are referring to slanderous words that were intended to destroy David. But whatever the case may be, whether literal or metaphorical, it's clear that the wicked were out to destroy David. The image here is that these evil rebels were like snipers in the shadows, just waiting for a clear shot at David to take him down, to take down the upright. And he was upright, meaning he knew the Lord. He loved the Lord. He obeyed the Lord from his heart because he was just and righteous. And because he was, what does David do with his advisors? He rebukes them. He rebukes them for worrying as they were. They were just looking at this situation from the human perspective instead of from God's perspective. You see what they were doing? They were urging David to look upon his enemies, and in so looking upon his enemies, they were encouraging him to take his eyes off the Lord. But David, we see here, didn't want to focus on his enemies. He didn't want to look at the size of his enemies and how inconquerable they may have seemed to have been. Instead, he wants to focus on the Lord and on the bigness of God. Why? Because he knew how big his God was. He knew by experience that his enemies were no match for God. David knew God was bigger than that lion, bigger than that bear, bigger than that big giant Philistine. And again, he was bigger than these present enemies that he was facing. But David's men lacked faith. They panicked. Because as they looked around, this wasn't just some kind of personal grudge. This had national implications. They panicked because they saw the foundations of the nations crumbling around them. And so they asked David rhetorically, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And what was their suggested answer? They can't do anything. That's what they're after. Now, the foundations here mentioned are referring to the foundations of society, which are based on God's law. So their destruction is referring to the disintegration of institutions that maintain law and order. And without these foundational institutions, what happens? Well, virtue cannot be protected and evil cannot be held back. So the rationale of David's counselors went like this. David, the citizens of Israel have rebelled against the Lord. They've rebelled against his commands. They've rebelled against you, God's anointed king. What are we to do? God's law, God's justice is being replaced by human rule. And the result of that, of course, is always going to end up being what? It's going to end up being anarchy. Moral values, spiritual values, civil order are all collapsing, David. The wicked have the upper hand on us who are the righteous. David, there's absolutely nothing we can do to rescue Israel from destruction, but we can at least save ourselves. So let's flee for the mountains. We'll be safe there. That'll be our refuge. That'll put us in a place that is high above any attacking enemies. It will be a strong defense, a secure place. What can the righteous do? Well, David's counselor said, this is what we should do. We should run. We should escape. We should isolate. And you know what? That is always the solution of those who lack faith. Run. Escape. Isolate. On an individual level, one who does this, when faced with problems, may retreat to drugs or alcohol or certain sinful behaviors. They are looking to these things to numb their inner pain. They are pulling away. Other individuals will try to escape their problems by just quitting. Quitting their marriage. Quitting their job. Quitting their church. Quitting friendships rather than deal with the challenges that confront them. But the problem is this, We simply cannot outrun our problems. And we can't outrun them because we're always going to be the same person we are. So the question is how are we going to deal with our problems? The only solution is to stay put, stand firm, put our faith in God. Because He doesn't want us to run away. He doesn't want us to run around our problems. He wants us to go through our problems with Him. I love the verse in Isaiah 43:2 that says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you." You see, the Lord promises to be with us through the troubles, to help us persevere through them. He said, "My grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in your weakness." If we will just trust Him, He will bring us through those fires of affliction. And when He does, we are told that we will be like precious gold. And what is precious gold like? It is strengthened, it is purified, and therefore we are more useful in serving Him. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of love, power, sound mind, or self-control. We got to remember that, yes, on an individual level, but we also need to remember that on a corporate level as well. As a church, we've got to remember this. As a church family, we cannot get to the point where we are saying, oh, everything in our American culture is just so bad. Let's just withdraw from it. You know, let's just withdraw into our little holy huddle. That kind of mindset runs counter to Scripture. Scripture commands us to be in the world while remaining distinct from it. And let me just say along these lines, let me warn you of parachurch organizations or parachurch clubs which encourage what we could call group escapism or group isolationism. In despair, these kind of groups basically say American culture is so bad, moral values, civil order is crumbling. And so we're going to form our group that will help maintain purity. And we won't let our children be tainted by the corrupt culture. You see what they're doing there? Because they despair over the world, they become afraid of the world and isolate themselves from the world. But the real problem with these kinds of groups is that they are formed on other things besides the gospel. Now, many of them that claim to be Christians will say, oh, no, that's not the case. No, we're really about the gospel. But in truth, they're really not. Really, their subculture is formed around certain moral issues or certain spiritual, ethical issues or family issues or political issues or certain rights or perhaps the education of their children or certain lifestyle standards. We could go on and on. These groups are not really formed around the gospel. And let me say, that is tragic. Because the gospel is the only solution to the world's problems. We must be in the world, having meaningful relationships with the lost, to take the gospel to the world. That's the mission of the church. And since I'm already picking on these parachurch organizations, let me just say, one of the things they do is they try to replace the church. And in so doing, replace the mission of the church. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? That's the question. Well, one thing the righteous shouldn't do is run and hide. They should trust in the Lord and face their problems with His help. They should stand against evil and they should proclaim the gospel because, again, that is the solution to societal's ills. What can the righteous do? Well, they can lay the foundation again. You know, each generation of Christians must examine itself and see if they have been faithful to the Lord. And they need to repent where they have failed. They need to pray for revival. And then they need to take the gospel to the world with a renewed vigor. And if they do that, then The foundations will be rebuilt. The foundations of truth, morality, social order, justice, they'll be rebuilt. Now, note, I did not say that will happen by overtaking government through elections. No, it's got to happen through gospel transformation that happens within the hearts of individuals. What can the righteous do when the foundations have collapsed? Well, they can trust God and see the collapse as an opportunity to rebuild. I like what Derek Kidner says on this score. He comments, the collapse of what is built on sand may be distressing, but it can also be a beginning. I think of the Protestant Reformation in this regard. The reformers did not run and hide. They did not despair over the condition of Europe being the spiritual and moral cesspool that it was. Instead, what did they do? They looked at those collapsed foundations as an opportunity to rebuild, to recover the gospel and let the gospel do the rebuilding. I love what Martin Luther said on this score. He said it about himself, but it really applies to all the reformers. What did they do? They simply prayed, they preached the gospel and let the word of God do the rest. That was the strategy. What can the righteous do? Well, like David, they can refuse to run and hide. Instead, stand firm and reaffirm their confidence in the Lord. Which brings us to the third thing believers must do. Reaffirm. Persecuted believers take refuge in the Lord by reaffirming faith in Him alone. So instead of focusing on the foes, as his counselors were doing, David fixed his eyes on the Lord, and he does this by reaffirming his faith in God. He proclaims four facts about God. Fact number one in verse 4, the Lord reigns over the righteous and unrighteous. David continues, the Lord is in his holy temple, the Lord's throne is in heaven. Now, in some of the Psalms, his holy temple could refer to the temple in Jerusalem, but that seems unlikely here since the temple had not even been built yet. And since we are in the Psalms and parallelism is such a big thing, it seems that holy temple here is in parallel to God's heavenly throne. David was reminding his advisors that the Lord sits in his heavenly throne, which is infinitely above his own throne. David had a right perspective on himself. The Lord reigns over everyone in Israel, David is saying, both the righteous and the unrighteous. God is in sovereign control. He's reigning over this situation, this painful trial, men. God's throne hasn't gone anywhere, he says. God's throne is not threatened by these enemies who have risen up against me. David knew this. He rested in this. And we need to do likewise when problems come our way. Listen, this is important. When we look around and see problems, that is the moment that we need to look up. An upward look is always the solution to problems around us. Why? Because God is over all. God sees all, is in control of all things. And in this case, from his heavenly seat on high, God could see everything that the wicked did against David. And that brings us to the second fact about God that David reaffirms. The Lord reviews the righteous and unrighteous. You see what he's saying here? From God's heavenly vantage point, he observes everyone. And in so doing, he differentiates between everyone. He differentiates between who is of the righteous and who are the unrighteous. His eyes see. His eyelids test the children of man. Interesting statement. It is speaking of God's scrutiny of all people. You see here, not only does God's eyes see, it says here, his eyelids also test. or examine. You know, when you examine something up closely, what do you do with your eyelids? Your eyelids contract. We usually say they squint when you're looking at something carefully. And this is what God does. He squints, as it were, to carefully discern the heart of every person, to judge whether they are righteous or whether they are unrighteous. And whenever he discerns a righteous heart, he purifies and strengthens it. David writes, "The Lord tests or examines the righteous." That was a word, test or examine, that was used for the refining of metals in a fire. And of course, likewise, the Lord uses tests, persecution, trials in our lives to remove the dross, to purify and to strengthen us. He tests us to bring out the best within us. His trials do not work against us. The trials he sends into our lives actually work for us. And David understood this. And so he saw this threat from his enemies not as a bad thing, but as a good thing. He saw their persecution as an opportunity for the Lord to grow him more. And we've got to remember this as well. We've got to understand that, and this is hard, particularly when we are in trials, right? But we've got to remember that God does not test us because he hates us. It's actually the opposite. It's because he loves us. He wants to use the tests in our life for our spiritual good, for his glory, to refine us, to put his approval on us through the testings. Again, because he loves us. But we notice here that is not the case for the wicked. The Lord rejects the unrighteous. Fact number 3. Verse 5, in contrast to the righteous whom he loves, God's soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. And we understand that holy God may not immediately judge the wicked, but we learn here that he ultimately withholds, excludes any love for them. He is opposed to those who do wickedness and to those who do violence, particularly those who do violence against his own children. And so they may try to shoot, as it were, arrows at the righteous, but the Lord protects his own. And not only does he protect them, but as he promises here, in the end, God is going to be the one that pulls out the bow and shoots the arrow right at the wicked. They will receive the very violence that they try to pour out on others. They will be the targets of his judgment. As it says here, on the wicked, he will rain coals of fire and sulfur, and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. David is using 3 rather striking images here to describe God's judgment. Notice, first of all, it says that God rains down fiery judgment upon the wicked like he did with Sodom and Gomorrah. So just as he did with those depraved cities, God will rain down judgment suddenly upon the wicked. And they will not be able to escape. Have you ever been caught in one of these torrential downpours? There's no way you can dodge all of those raindrops falling down upon you. Well, that's how it's going to be for the wicked. They will not be able to escape God's wrath that rains down upon them. Second, God's judgment destroys the wicked like scorching, ravaging wind. During the change of seasons in the Middle East, particularly from spring to summer and then summer to fall, the hot desert wind blows over the Middle East. And when this happens, the vegetation changes literally overnight. It goes from living vegetation green to plants that are utterly withered up. And likewise, under God's scorching judgment, the wicked will wither as grass and fall like the flowers of the field. Third, God gives the wicked a cup of his undiluted wrath. As probably many of you are aware, that the cup is a symbol of God's anger, of God's judgment against the wicked. It is as a poison chalice from which the wicked must drink to their own destruction. Now, thankfully, we who know Christ can speak of Jesus, who drank down the bitter dregs of God's wrath for us, for his own people, for their salvation. The final fact that David reaffirms about the Lord is that he rewards the righteous. Here's how David concludes his psalm. He does so by declaring, "For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face." Because God is righteous, he not only negatively hates wickedness, but you'll notice here he positively loves righteous deeds that the redeemed do. So while on the one hand he lifts up his hand in judgment against the wicked, he also lifts up his face toward the upright. And who are the upright? Well, they are those who trust in God, and those who follow his ways. And as a result, it says here, they shall behold his face. Interesting expression there. It was used in ancient times to describe a loyal citizen who was granted access into the king's presence. And this perfectly describes believers. They are admitted into the King of Heaven's presence. This idea here is referring to God's favor upon his children. Favor that he is rewarding them now and forever. So unlike unbelievers who drink eternally of the cup of God's wrath and hell forever, we learn here that believers will forever dwell in the light of God's glorious presence. As the Apostle John says in Revelation, they will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord will be their light. And again, this is only possible because Jesus drank of the Father's wrath for us, for our salvation. I quoted him this morning. Let me do so again tonight. Donald Gray Barnhouse said, "Christianity can be expressed in three phrases. I deserved hell. Jesus took hell for me. There's nothing left for me but his heaven." I hope that's your testimony, and I hope that's your perspective tonight, because if it is, then by God's grace, like David, you will persevere to the end. By God's grace, you'll be able to take refuge in the Lord, both during personal trials and also when the foundations of society are crumbling all around you. What should the righteous do when the foundations are crumbling? Well, to sum it up, they should look up and not around in fear. Look up in faith, not around in fear. Further, they should believe that God sees everything and examines both the righteous and the unrighteous. Further still, the righteous should rejoice in trials, knowing that they are actually opportunities for their spiritual growth. Also, the righteous should rest assured that God will judge the wicked. And finally, the righteous should walk in righteousness, knowing that they will be eternally rewarded with the glorious presence of God forever. In short, in a society of crumbling foundations, we must take refuge in the Lord. Let's bow for prayer.